This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington.
Hi, my name's Lacey from Overland Park, Kansas.
Hey, this is Alyssa Baker from Steamboat Springs, Colorado.
My name is Marika. I'm a pharmacist in Richmond, Virginia at a hospital.
I am actually in the parking lot waiting to go inside to get my Moderna vaccine.
Today is the day as a company we are getting our vaccines, and we're really excited about it. It will definitely make for a safer workplace.
I got my first vaccine dose the first week it was available, and it was very emotional. I was excited to get it. My mom cried when she found out. She's in New York City, far away, and I just want to hug her, and I feel like it's one step closer.
Those are some of the messages you left us about your experience getting a COVID-19 vaccine. According to the CDC, 4.5 million people have received the first dose. That's a far cry from the 20 million projected to be vaccinated by the end of the year. In the coming weeks and months, what can we expect from the effort to distribute and administer COVID-19 vaccines around the U.S., and will it be enough? Here to answer that and more is virologist Angela Rasmussen. She's an affiliate at the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Angela, it's great to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me, Jen.
Also with us is emergency room physician Dr. Lena Wen. She's a visiting professor of health policy at George Washington University. She's also the former health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. Dr. Wen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Great to join you.
So, Angela, the U.S. now has two vaccines authorized for emergency use by the FDA, one made by Pfizer, one made by Moderna. Give us an overview of these two vaccines and how they differ in terms of their efficacy and side effects.
So both of these vaccines are actually quite similar. They're both what are called mRNA vaccines, meaning that they are a type of molecule called messenger RNA or mRNA that is packaged in a lipid nanoparticle that allows that mRNA to get into your cells. And what that mRNA does is it encodes the instructions for your cells to make the spike protein from SARS coronavirus 2. Your cells will make that protein, and then your immune system will respond to that. So that way, when you are exposed to SARS coronavirus 2, you will mount a protective immune response against it, and you won't, you at least won't develop severe COVID disease. And many people, you probably won't become infected either. There's not really a lot that's different in terms of their efficacy. One of them is 94% efficacious. The other is 95%. So practically, that's not really a major difference. They both have similar side effects or adverse effect profiles. The majority of people who get these vaccines don't have very serious side effects at all. Some people do have more severe flu-like symptoms, but that can be addressed by taking over-the-counter medications. They're both effectively safe and efficacious vaccines. And if you have access to them, I encourage people to get them.
Well, we know some medical professionals as well as members of the general public have expressed concern about the vaccine development and concern about it being rushed. There's a lot of misinformation about this as well that's flourished online. What do you say to people who are concerned about the vaccine?
Well, what I say to people who are concerned about that, first of all, is that many of the concerns are valid. I completely understand where people are coming from, that this does seem, and it is, very expedited compared to what the normal vaccine development process is like. But I try to let people know that the vaccine process, while rushed, was not rushed because many things were cut out of it. It's because many of the normal things that occur sequentially, one after the other, actually occurred simultaneously. So they did preclinical studies, which is when they experimentally infect vaccinated laboratory animals at the same time as they did the early stage clinical trials. Then they did phase 3 clinical trials, and the one thing they didn't look at was what's called durability, or the length of time that protection lasts after you're vaccinated. But they did look at efficacy and safety the same way that they do for every other vaccine that's developed. So not a lot was actually cut out of the development process and the trial process from what we normally evaluate with any other vaccine for any other pathogen. And hopefully that addresses at least some of the concerns about the process being rushed and corners being cut.
Well, let's listen to a clip from an NBC News interview with Dr. Anthony Fauci.
I mean, we'd have liked to have seen it run smoothly and have 20 million doses into people today by the end of the 2020, which was the projection. Obviously, it didn't happen. and that's disappointing. Hopefully, as you get into the first couple of weeks in January, the gaining of momentum will get us to the point where we want to be. But there really has to be a lot more effort in the sense of resources for the locals.
Angela, we know there's a major gap between the amount of vaccine doses that have been distributed so far in the U.S., which is more than 15 million, according to the CDC, and the amount that's been administered, which is about 4.5 million. Why is this lag happening?
That's an excellent question, and I might defer that to a clinician like Dr. Wen, just because I don't really understand what's going on with the distribution problems. Mm-hmm. This is really what Operation Warp Speed was supposed to address, and I thought that they were fairly prepared for it. Now, that said, I think that there are always going to be hiccups in terms of distributing a vaccine, especially when you have a product that's in short supply and that's greatly needed. I think some of this may have to do with the fact that the federal government is actually not controlling the vaccine distribution efforts once the vaccines are allocated to different states. And every state has a very different procedure about how those doses are actually getting out there. So that may be part of the reason for this. But ultimately, my answer is I don't know, because this is really an unacceptable problem that we need to solve immediately before we start worrying about dosing regimens and things like that.
Well, Dr. Wen, I want to turn to you. You recently wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post arguing that the federal government should take a series of steps to expedite the vaccine rollout. Do you think the issues we're seeing so far have to do with the fact that there isn't that sort of centralized rollout plan coming from the federal government?
In one word, yes. So here is what I think has gone wrong in this process. And I think we're going to find out more as the days go by about whether this is the case and how we can fix it. But it seems that a lot of this originated from the federal government, as we're now finding out, basically washing their hands once the vaccines are distributed to the states. It seems that that was their expectation all along, which was to develop the vaccines in record time, which we absolutely have to give them, as well as the scientists, credit for. But then once the vaccines are distributed, there was no strategy for what happens after that. State and local health departments have been sounding this alarm for months. They've been saying, look, we are trying to do our best, running every other aspect of pandemic response. They were already substantially underfunded even prior to the pandemic. Then they had to stand up testing, run contact tracing, do every element of public education, while also helping businesses and schools to reopen safely. Now you're asking them to also take on the responsibility of standing up the most ambitious vaccination program our country has ever taken on. And they've been saying for months, we don't have the resources to do this. We need, first of all, we need guidance from the federal government. There should be a national strategy. Why should every state be trying to figure out how to recruit vaccinators, trying to figure out what kind of licenses are necessary, trying to recruit retired nurses and pharmacists and whether they can mobilize students and what kind of liability protections that might require. Why should states also have to be the ones setting up vaccination centers and buying mobile vans when they're spending all their resources trying to ramp up testing at the same time? And so that kind of prep work should have been done months ago. We really needed the federal government to step in at that point to say, what is it that you all need as states to implement this? You know how to do this, but we, the federal government, we need to be basically trying to break down all these other barriers to allow you to do this effectively.
Let's pause for a moment. I want to hear more about what could happen. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Life Kit is rethinking New Year's resolutions. All this January, we're thinking about both really big and really small changes. If you're wanting to change up your life and start fresh, we've got you covered. If you're looking to just make your home a little nicer, we got you there too. Listen now to the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're answering your questions about the COVID-19 vaccines with virologist Angela Rasmussen and emergency room physician Dr. Lena Wen. I want to get to a couple of calls, but briefly, Dr. Wen, we know we have a new administration coming into the White House. What would you like to see from them in terms of vaccine distribution and how they can coordinate the response?
Well, I'd like to see three things. First, they should set the expectation that this is huge, urgent. There's huge urgency here. This needs to be an all hands on deck, 24/7 process for us to ramp up the speed of administration. Second is the federal government should be establishing targets for each locale, and then they should be asking state and local health departments, what do you need in order to achieve that? And the third is the federal government also needs to be working on streamlining processes, helping with staffing, helping with space, and these other things that really only the federal government can be doing, because this is a wartime effort that requires a wartime mobilization.
Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Liza in Massachusetts. Liza, you got the vaccine. Tell us about why you made that decision.
So I am a registered nurse. I'm also African-American. And I actually wanted to do that to give my patients firsthand experience of my vaccination. Even within my coworkers, they do not want to take the vaccination. And I mean, it saddens me. But I wonder if this, I know you mentioned about making some type of effort, but what are we doing as far as bringing education into the minority so they can trust it? Because there's a large mistrust within that community. I mean, it makes me sad, but I want to know if we can do a global education, something that we can bring to the community so they can trust it.
Thanks for that question, Liza. Angela, this is something we've talked about before, that there is an understandable mistrust of the medical community, especially among communities of color. And what kind of education efforts are happening right now to try to instill confidence in this vaccine, in these vaccines, I should say?
So I think that this is something that's going to require an all hands on deck situation as well, with distribution, as Dr. Nguyen was talking about. I think that we need to have people like myself talking about things like how the vaccines work, just educating people on the underlying science, but particularly for communities of color, I think that they also need to be hearing from scientists and physicians and providers of color explaining why they themselves are getting vaccinated. And I've seen many of my colleagues, particularly many of my Black physician colleagues, doing this exact type of work, taking the opportunity where they have it to reach out to their communities proactively to communicate exactly why the vaccine is so important and trying to build that trust. I think that there's only so much that somebody like myself, a white woman, can do to address those concerns. And it's not as simple as just educating people about the science underlying it, because that really ignores the long and painful history of exploitation that has occurred for some of these communities, which are being disproportionately affected by this pandemic because of disparities that exist to this day. So I think this is really something that needs to be addressed from multiple fronts by multiple people with multiple backgrounds and areas of expertise.
We got this email from Jamie who says, I'm in healthcare in Arizona and have been trying to sign up for the vaccine. It can't be more confusing as to how to get it. I've been trying to get in line, but figuring out how to register is difficult. Dr. Nguyen, any advice for Jamie?
This is exactly the problem that we're seeing across the country, that there is such a piecemeal approach. For Jamie and for others, it really depends on what institution you're with. Many large hospital systems have received the vaccine, but even they have come into, they have had a lot of problems with figuring out who to prioritize. There have been systems that have crashed or people who had to sign up all at once. But if you happen to be working on shift at the time, you can't sign up because you're literally working and treating patients, so you can't sign up in the system. And then there are clinicians who work outside of major hospital chains who are in private practice who really have nowhere to go at the moment because they're not with a hospital that could give them the vaccine. So a lot of this requires watchful waiting, because I suspect that at some point pretty soon, it is going to be open season for a much larger group of people, especially as the current vaccines that are in storage are not able to get out. And I think we should all see it as a profound tragedy that there are millions of doses of vaccine sitting in freezers when there are thousands of people dying every day.
Angela, what can you tell us about how states are making these decisions about who gets access to the vaccine when?
So in part, states are making the decisions based on the recommendations of a committee for immunization practices, the ACIP, that is composed of people from the CDC, as well as people from the FDA and scientists and other stakeholders from the community who've made these recommendations. And other times, some states are making decisions based on what's going on within their states. But as Dr. Wen was discussing earlier, there's really no centralized guidance other than the recommendations that have been made by ACIP for states to go on. So in many states, this process has broken down because they weren't really prepared to be sort of dynamically deciding how to distribute vaccines to which groups of people. And I think it's very confusing for a lot of people because, you know, there are a lot of older people. Not all of them are in long-term care facilities, but many of them have other comorbidities in addition to being at risk because of their age. It's just very difficult to make those sort of decisions on the fly if you don't have a great plan in place ahead of time to do that. And then there's the issue that Dr. Wen also addressed of many of our vaccine doses are sitting in freezers and haven't yet been allocated to the states. So they're trying to really work with a limited number of doses and vaccinate the most amount of people. But this is really breaking down because, again, there aren't really very robust plans in place in many states to accomplish this.
Let's go back to this question from David in Louisville, Kentucky, who asks, will enough people be encouraged to receive the vaccine for it to make the necessary difference? And Angela, David is referencing the concept of herd immunity. Remind us what that means and whether we know when or if the vaccines could get us there.
So herd immunity is the concept that a virus needs a host in order to replicate. And in order to spread within a population, it needs to be able to jump around to new hosts that are still susceptible. When you reach the what's called the herd immunity threshold, that's when you have enough people in the population that are immune to the virus that the virus can no longer spread effectively within that population. So we still don't know what the herd immunity threshold is. And we actually also don't know how protective these vaccines are so far against being infected, period, or against being able to transmit it to others, although it is likely that these vaccines do at least reduce community transmission significantly. So what we don't know is how many people are actually going to have to get vaccinated in order to reach that herd immunity threshold. Unfortunately, it looks like it's probably going to be a lot more than 60%, which is sort of the lower estimate for the herd immunity threshold based on epidemiological data. And the reason we think that is that there have been situations where there has been a very high prevalence rate and the virus is still spreading very efficiently even after a number of people have already been infected. In the city of Manaus, Brazil, upwards of 75% of the population has been infected and there are still outbreaks occurring. So suggesting that of all those people, we're going to need the majority of people to be vaccinated in order to completely reduce community transmission of this virus. And that's not just the majority of the people in the U.S. That's the majority of people worldwide, because this is a pandemic. And so by definition, it's not just affecting one country. It's affecting the entire world wherever people live. So this is going to be a very long-term effort. It's probably going to take years before we're completely free of SARS coronavirus 2.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Amela. She's an RN in Tallahassee. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. My question is that I had the symptoms on the 25th and was diagnosed with the COVID, but I was not sure how soon after getting the infection should I get vaccinated. So I was worried about getting reinfected with the virus because I work with COVID patients. So I did go ahead, got the vaccination on January the 2nd, and I am planning to go ahead with the schedule for the second dose and get it. So the question is, how, you know, is it safe to get the vaccine after, you know, the infection with the virus, or is there a window of time should one wait before getting vaccinated?
Thanks for that question, Amela. Dr. Wen, I'll give that question to you.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and there are no hard and fast rules about this. This is another one where we have some data and some recommendations based on it, but it does need to be tailored to the individual. So what the CDC recommends is that if somebody has had coronavirus in the last 90 days, that they can wait to get the vaccine. They're not saying this, by the way, based on safety. They're more saying this based on the fact that if you've just had coronavirus, the chance of you getting reinfected with coronavirus is very, very low. In fact, there are few cases of reinfection, even for people who had it, let's say, 6 months ago. We don't know how long immunity lasts. We don't know how complete immunity is from getting it from infection. But we know that it lasts for some period of time. And so if the caller had not already gotten her first dose, one could say she could wait 90 days or about 3 months after she had coronavirus in order to get her vaccine, because she probably is protected for that period of time. Since it sounds like she already got the first dose of the vaccine and then, as I understand, got coronavirus, she should complete the vaccination on schedule. So she should still get the second dose of the vaccine, which, depending on whether she got the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine, is 3 to 4 weeks after the first dose. So she should complete the two doses. But for other people who have had coronavirus before, it certainly is safe to get the vaccine. But if you've had it recently, you can wait 90 days until after you've had coronavirus to get your vaccine.
Well, we have to take a quick break, but we'll answer more questions about COVID-19 vaccines right after this. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Does your economy seem sluggish? Are your interest rates feeling abnormally low? Your economy might be exhibiting symptoms of a once-in-a-lifetime recession. Ask your podcast provider about a twice-weekly dose of Planet Money. The economy can be perplexing. NPR's Planet Money can help.
This is 1A. Let's go back to the phones. We've got David in Cincinnati. David, what's your question?
I was wondering about the new, more contagious strain that's out there, because I'm a school bus driver and I have to sanitize my bus after every load of students. And I'm wondering, is it more contagious because it lasts longer in the air or on surfaces? Or what is it that makes it more contagious?
David, thanks for that question. And Angela, this is a strain that was first identified in the UK, but it's now been found in Florida, California, and Colorado. What can you tell us about the new strain and how David should think about sanitizing his bus?
Yeah, so this is a great question that David asked, and it's a really important question that's on the mind of myself and all of my colleagues. And the short answer is, right now, we don't actually know why this variant is more transmissible, just that it is. And it could be a lot of different things. It could be that the virus is persisting for a longer period of time in the air or on surfaces. It could be that people who are infected with this variant are shedding higher viral titers or higher viral loads. It could be that some of the mutations in the spike protein allow the virus to enter cells more efficiently. It could be that the virus has evolved ways to circumvent the innate antiviral immune responses that occur in cells. So it could be a lot of different things, and the research is underway to try and figure that out. But what David really, I think, wants to know is how can he protect himself? So not only sanitizing his bus, but also just generally protecting himself from exposure. And what people should understand about these more transmissible variants is that while they are more transmissible, there's no indication that it's because they're being transmitted by some other route. So mutation does not render a virus a super-powered pathogen. It doesn't give it the ability to suddenly transmit by new and different ways. So the same measures that David can take to reduce transmission of any variant of SARS coronavirus 2 will also help protect him and reduce his risk for exposure to this particular variant. And that means disinfecting high-touch surfaces, washing his hands, wearing a mask at all times, and hoping that the students who are riding on his bus are also wearing masks, physically distancing where possible, increasing ventilation. This could be opening the bus window, for example, and trying to limit the duration of time that he's spending in enclosed spaces with other people. And that applies not just on a bus or in somebody's workplace. That really applies everywhere. So the same guidance that we're giving to people to reduce their risk over the holidays, for example, avoiding gatherings, masking, physically distancing, et cetera, will apply for these variants as well. So that's the good news, and I really do encourage people to really double down their efforts to apply those exposure risk reduction methods in their daily lives, because right now our situation was already dire before we detected the emergence of these variants, and an increase in transmissibility on top of the out-of-control community transmission that we're already seeing is going to have really dire consequences for our healthcare system. So I really do encourage people to be extra vigilant about risk reduction.
Well, let's get to one more voicemail. Here's what one of you wanted to know about the COVID-19 vaccines.
Hi there. My name is Katie, and I'm calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. I am wondering, for women that are pregnant but are also considered essential workers, you know, I know they weren't in clinical trials, but is there a benefit to getting the vaccine, or is it just, you know, hold off because there's really just not enough data about the efficacy of vaccines and any side effects or risks with women that are pregnant?
Dr. Nguyen, when vaccine trials began last year, you were pregnant. You wrote in an op-ed last month that you weren't eligible to volunteer until after you stopped breastfeeding. At this stage, what do we know about pregnant women and the COVID vaccines?
This is such a great question. So pregnant women and breastfeeding women were not included in the initial vaccine trials. And so there's a lot that we don't know. There are some women who became pregnant over the course of the trial, because when you have tens of thousands of people enrolled in trials, pregnancy occurs. But we have very limited information from these individuals. There's no reason for us to believe that the vaccine would be any less efficacious in pregnant women. We don't fully know about safety. We just really don't know because of lack of information. But that said, the FDA and CDC have not said that pregnant women should not take the vaccine. And what that means is it really should be up to the individual to determine her own risk factors. So, for example, if you are an ICU nurse or respiratory therapist and you have high levels of exposure to coronavirus and you're also pregnant, you might consider that the benefit to you of getting the vaccine outweighs any theoretical risk that we just don't know about. On the other hand, if you are someone who is able to keep social distancing, who is able to wait until there's more data, then you might consider holding off on getting the vaccine at this time. This is, again, a decision that one needs to weigh carefully, understanding also that pregnancy is another state that renders one potentially more vulnerable to severe effects from COVID-19 as well.
Angela, we know things vary significantly from state to state, but what's your best guidance for how people find out where they can get vaccinated?
So this is a really important question, and my short answer is that I don't actually know. They should talk to their primary care providers, but I might actually also flip this question over to Dr. Nguyen, because as both a healthcare provider and as somebody who is a former health commissioner, I think she may actually have better information specifically for Marion's question, since I believe she's also in the D.C. area.
Dr. Nguyen?
Yeah, I agree with the recommendation to call your primary care doctor, although I will say that most physicians' offices don't know the answer either. And this illustrates that fundamental problem in our system. We're seeing now what happens, for example, in Florida, where there are seniors who are eligible to get the vaccine, but are waiting in lines overnight in order to try to get one of the very few vaccines that are available. My best advice actually is to hold off, because you are going to get information soon in the next month. I would say people should be hearing about how they'll be able to access vaccines in their area if they are in one of these groups of being elderly or are an essential worker. But I would also just want to highlight what's happening in Israel, one of the countries that has had a very successful implementation program. There's an app that the government has helped to set up, where people can input all their information, then they're told exactly where to go and when to go. And all that paperwork is cut out so that at the time that you go to get your vaccine, you just get the shot. You don't also have to get your paperwork and everything else done at that time. That's what we should have here.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Carrie in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Carrie, go ahead with your question.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. Here's my scenario. Let's say in the summer, the vast majority of people who want the vaccination get it, and there are going to be the anti-maskers who don't want it. My question is this. After myself, my family, my friends get the vaccination, why do I care if the others get it or not? Why do I care? If I'm protected, my family's protected. I know this is cynical, but for the anti-maskers, if herd immunity can't be reached, those that don't take the vaccine are going to get it. Why do I care?
Carrie, thanks for that call. Angela, I'm going to come to you on this one, because one of the things I think we're grappling with right now is the incredible amount of stress that's been placed on our healthcare system and what that means for people who have other conditions that need to be treated, heart conditions. If someone has a stroke, the availability of care just isn't there because of this pandemic.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Jen. And even, so right now, I think that people really need to understand that our healthcare system is in completely dire straits. And regardless of what somebody's position on masking or vaccination or politics is, if enough people are infected, if enough people are being hospitalized, then that puts so much strain on our healthcare system that other people who don't have COVID will not be able to access the care that they need. So that's one problem. When the caller is talking about what the situation is going to be like next summer, which we hopefully won't be in this situation of an overburdened healthcare system by then, why should you care if people who are denying science or are opposed to masks or vaccination are going to get sick? The reason you should care about that is not only because they're fellow human beings with families and people who love them, but also because it's not just them. This is a contagious disease. This is a contagious virus. And there are other people out there who can't get vaccinated for various reasons. There are people for whom vaccines are medically counterindicated. There are people who don't have access to healthcare or access to vaccines. And many of those people are also going to be vulnerable. So if you have people getting infected, they can spread it to others. And so that's why we need to think about this in terms of reducing infections as much as possible, regardless of who is getting infected. Because even if it's somebody that you don't agree with, I'm presuming that most people don't want others in their community to die for disagreeing with them about something. And I certainly, even though I deal with a lot of people who think that I'm wrong about a lot of things or that I'm too political or whatever, I don't want those people to get sick despite the fact that we might not always see eye to eye. So I think it's really important for as many people to get vaccinated as possible, but also to have some understanding that other people, even if they're, not behaving in the same way or they're not as supportive of public health as you are, they also, we need to protect them as well. We need to look out for our entire communities and not just the people that we personally care about or personally agree with.
Let's quickly try to get in one last call. We've got Doug from Maryland. Doug, what's your question?
Well, this all started when President-elect Biden announced that his goal would be to get 100 million people vaccinated in the first 100 days in office. And I thought about that and I said, well, given what Dr. Fauci has said, his latest estimate of herd immunity is achieved at around 80% of the population 16 years and older. And because I'm a veteran of the Census Bureau, I know how to get that number, 16 years and older.
Just a couple of seconds.
And it was pretty simple arithmetic. Just a simple arithmetic to come up with. Over 2 million shots per day would be needed if you wanted to get herd immunity by the end of June.
So, Dr. Nguyen, we've only got about 30 seconds here. Is Biden's goal reasonable?
I think it's reasonable. I don't think it goes far enough, but we have to start somewhere. So I think if we can ramp up to 1 million a day in the next month, ultimately we should be at 3 million a day in order to reach herd immunity anytime soon.
Thanks for that call, Doug. And thanks to Dr. Lena Nguyen. She's a visiting professor of health policy at George Washington University and the former health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. Also with us was virologist Angela Rasmussen. She's an affiliate at the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Dr. Nguyen, Angela, it's always great to have you on the show. Today's conversation was produced by Catherine Fink, and it was edited by Barb Anguiano. You can learn more about them and the rest of the team online at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more tomorrow. This is 1A.